as a young kid and influences on you. Oops. Okay, I see the brown tape now. So, this is Paul Rodel once more. And the Oral History Project on IVS. And today is August the 30th. Gee, we're getting close to September. It is going fast. Yeah. Don was in Vietnam from 1960 through 1962, working in agriculture, and under supervision then of Gordon Brockmuller.
And Don Luce.
And later Don Luce, yeah. I should tell you that when Gordon spoke about his time in Vietnam, he said that that batch of people starting, you know, around 59 through 62 were really very good, and he was really proud of everybody in that program at that time. Anyway, so much for introductions. Let's get into your own thing. Our first question basically is a very open-ended one. You know, it can be more casual and conversational style rather than interrogation. Like to know when and where you were born and who your parents were. You know, not just their names, but what they did for a living and their influence on you and anything else that influenced you as a young kid growing up.
Well, I was born in 1926, Arlington, mm-hmm. Wisconsin. I grew up on a small farm.
Where's Arlington?
About 15 miles south of here.
Oh, that's all. Okay. All right.
If you had gone on 51, you had come very close to it. Uh-huh. As it is, you came 2 miles from it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was on the expressway. Yeah.
It was a small, relatively small farm as far as U.S. farms go.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was, in some sense, kind of not real modern. That is, when it came to things like machinery. But he was very sound on things that counted, that is, the soil, his crops, and the livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did our work mostly the hard way, without too much machinery or labor-saving devices. That's the way I grew up.
How did you plow?
Oh, he plowed with a walking plow, team horses mostly,
okay.
And a walking plow.
Did you learn that method too?
No, because I could never do it good enough for him.
Oh, okay.
He was a perfectionist.
Uh-huh.
When it came to things like that, and he had no patience, and he was a poor teacher.
Uh-oh.
And he would only get mad at me when I couldn't. So I said, heck with it.
Yeah, so you tried a couple times, and it wasn't good enough for the old man.
No. Actually, he was recognized as the best plowman in the mm-hmm. whole prairie, and when they had contests, he always won. And and he was an expert horseman too.
So is that?
And
he had high standards.
He had high standards for me, which I didn't quite live up to, and the things that he was good at.
Well, that happens.
But anyway, I did learn to work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And to do things with my hands and back, and I did have these standards of perfection when it came to doing things in the field and and with animals.
He passed that along to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your mother? Who was your mother?
Oh, well, she she was a good woman.
Mm-hmm.
Worked very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And well, father wasn't much of a manager when it came to finances either.
Ah, so she really kept the books.
She had to, or else we would have starved. He would have given all his money away to, with nothing to show for it. And so she took care of that. She was quite a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
He went to church on Easter and Christmas. But
she was more often, huh?
Yeah, that was about it. Be always sure that we got to Sunday school on time. That kind of thing.
Sounds like my mother. What church was that?
Well, that was then it was called the Evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
It later joined with the United Brethren to become the Evangelical United Brethren, which later became absorbed by the Methodists, so they're part of the Methodist Church now.
Oh, okay. Doesn't have anything to do with the Brethren as
no,
opposed to,
okay. No.
All right. Just the word signaled that to me.
Was that some of your background?
Or? No. It's just that the Brethren were one of the three churches that founded IVS.
Yeah,
I know. Maybe,
I know.
I thought maybe you had some sort of tie through that.
No, but of course the Methodists have been one that have been supporting it more than, I guess, anybody else since.
Could be, yeah. Well, what about some of the influences on your life? You've got your family and your father and passing along your standards for perfection and your mom providing some of the religious things. What about beyond the
family?
Well,
I'd have to say the school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I went to high school, our school had probably the poorest facilities of any of the schools around. But for some reason or another, we were always lucky to have very good teachers.
Mm-hmm.
In this school with poor facilities.
Yeah, sometimes you don't need the Cadillac if you've got...
And I guess I would have to give credit to those teachers from grade school through high school.
Yeah.
Probably, there were three who I'd have to mention. One would be my English teacher.
Mm.
I had no use for English when I was of that age.
Yeah.
And I was a very poor English student.
Mm-hmm.
As far as her grades that she gave me, sometimes sometimes D's, more often C's. But apparently I learned something from her, because mm-hmm. when I got to the University of Wisconsin my first year, my freshman year, the only A I achieved was in English.
Oh, no.
And if it hadn't been for that A, I probably would have flunked out.
Oh, no.
My grade point was just on that...
On that borderline?
On that borderline. So that pulled me through the first year, and well, after that it became kind of clear sailing.
Yeah?
After I got established. I had been out of school for 4 years before from high school. I had been in the Army 2 years.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I stayed home to help for a couple of years at home before I got there. So I had forgotten just about everything else from high school except English.
Because she drilled it into you so hard.
She drilled it in. And I didn't appreciate it in high school times, but later I did, of course.
Yeah.
And then there was my ag teacher.
Okay, you had ag in high school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good. That was our best department in the whole school.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a principal we had who was super outstanding. I don't know what's happening to my voice here. A very outstanding individual. He he was a big, strong, physical guy.
Mm-hmm.
He had started out playing for with the Green Bay Packers. But his
yeah, you better be physical.
But he broke his neck.
Ooh.
I guess his first year. So he quit and went into education work. But he was he also did our coaching of our small football team. We only had six-man football back then in a small school.
Six-man football?
And he was a super coach with us. And he was a very high moral guy. He preached a sermon almost every time he taught a class and held a football meeting.
How would you play six-man football?
Well, we had three linemen and three in the backfield.
Huh, we had okay.
Two ends, a center, and a quarterback, and two running backs.
That's just kind of like a little pickup game in a sense. But
no, it was rugged.
Yeah, I mean, it would be rugged, but I mean, it's not like, you know, it would be like different sets of kids around a neighborhood getting together and choosing, you know, and not having the full number of teams.
Yeah,
and
it was a wide open game.
Uh-huh.
The one thing that was restricted a little bit was the running. There had to be a pass before a runner could take off and run with the ball. That is.
So the first thing.
Quarter,
is a pass.
There had to be at least a handoff. You couldn't have a direct from center to the guy who was going to run.
Uh huh. Okay. And so the quarterback could not run.
No, that's right.
The quarterback couldn't run, and he always had to at least do a handoff.
Yeah,
or a forward pass.
Or throw a pass or a side pass. And the first down was not 10. You had to go 15 yards for a first down.
And was this tackle?
Oh, yes, it was
all
tackle.
Right, okay.
It was smash mouth. It was smash mouth football.
Oh, wow. No, I had never heard of this. And this has nothing to do with IBS, and so maybe I should have paused this. But the concept of playing in a high school for a six-man game. Kind of brutal.
I guess it had some effect on my life because the first year I played, there were just a bunch of us green kids. They had a team of seniors that graduated before, and they had nobody coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out there. We were sophomores for the most part then. None of us had played or even was on the team as freshmen.
Uh-oh.
So we came out there as green sophomores and usually running up against that first year against senior-dominated teams.
You'd be in trouble.
And we were in trouble. We took beatings after beatings. more physically than on the scoreboard. They didn't run away with us too often on the scoreboard, but we were beaten up physically at the end of almost every game. But by the time we were seniors, well, nobody was even close to us. We were
the
best six-man football team in the state.
You've been toughened.
Yeah. So that had some influence on me, I think. Stick with it kind of thing, you know. And maybe you'll get there.
Yeah, well, no, that's important. I don't know if everyone learns that kind of lesson. When things come too easy.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that's lacking.
And I spent 2 years in the Army.
Which is another influence.
And I don't know what I really have to say about it, except that I was glad that I was able to do it. I didn't do anything significant. I was very lucky. I went in December of 1944 when I was 18. I took basic training and was about ready to depart for Europe when the war there ended.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Fort Meade, Maryland, ready to ship out. And then Congress passed a law saying that for 18-year-olds to go into combat, they had to have 6 months training. I had only three at that time, and I was still 18. So I was sent to Texas for more training until mm-hmm. I got to be 19,
mm-hmm.
and got on the boat to go to the Asia conflict, and the bombs were dropped while I was on the boat. So I didn't get into any mm-hmm. combat at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty lucky, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have anybody shoot at me, and I didn't have to shoot at anybody else.
That is fortunate.
Well, that's pretty much that, yeah. up to that.
And then you get to the University of Wisconsin. This is the Madison campus.
Yeah.
And why did you go back to college?
Well, there was nothing. I had the GI Bill of Rights.
Okay. Oh, you still qualified for that, at least.
Which I could go to school on, and uh-huh. I had nothing at home.
Okay. All right.
There was no future for me at a small farm.
Okay. And what did you... See, I asked you what you went back to school for. I didn't realize that, of course, you would have had the GI Bill, but I was thinking, what course of study were you interested in when you were...
Well, I really didn't know. I knew I wanted to be in agriculture.
Okay.
And what I wanted to...
Why don't we eat first before you have learned?
I just kind of... I just kind of evolved into the things that I knew best from home, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It was agronomy, crops and soils, and dairy.
Uh-huh.
That's what I...
So you wanted to follow up on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the way it went. And then I had to have when I got to be a junior, I still didn't have a major between... crops and soils on one hand and dairy livestock on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to be a senior, I had to write down a major. And well, I'm a sensitive one, and I'd always cry when we'd sell an old cow. You know? So I stuck with agronomy because I wouldn't have to fall in love with an animal
that's
and
right.
sell it to market.
Right, yeah. You could just deal with a plant and that'd be no problem.
Yeah. So then I went to work with the university after that.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were with, that you had been out working for a while before IVS.
Yeah, I spent 7 years
mm-hmm.
Up at Ashland in the far north.
Oh, okay.
Of the state.
Where it's nice and warm.
Yeah, it gets cool.
Yeah, yeah, I'll bet.
But not quite as much as you might think.
Mm-hmm.
As far as feeling it.
Yeah, yeah.
The air is always drier in the winter time when they get 30 below.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sometimes doesn't feel as bad as 10 below down here.
Mm. So you were what, in?
Research agronomist.
Oh, okay.
At one of their outlying stations, experiment mm-hmm. stations.
So not in teaching, but just in pure research?
Kind of research extension.
Yeah.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly research, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We should maybe heed your wife's invitation and have something to eat and come back to this later.
I guess so.
So I'll turn this off. Still on the first side, and I turned it on again. So the wheels are running. We've just finished lunch now.
Yeah.
So both of us will probably talk a little bit slower.
Fall asleep.
If you hear snores, that's never mind.
Uh,
And okay.
I got it.
Sure thing. Back on go. I've taken it off hold or pause. Yeah, we were up to your post college and your work in Ashland and your research extension stuff.
Yeah. I had earlier indicated a sensitivity to about killing animals and that kind
of
thing.
Oh, that's right, yeah. And going with the plants. And
and then along that line, I became familiar with the writings of Albert Schweitzer.
Okay.
So I went in deeply. Every writing that he did that was translated into English, I guess I got a hold of it.
Really?
Read it, and I was kind of a disciple of his.
Uh-huh.
And then about the same time, Tom Dooley over in Laos was becoming very prominent in in the U.S. Almost seemed everybody knew who Tom Dooley was for a while back there.
Absolutely.
And at the same time...
you read his books, too?
I read his books, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that went along with it was at a time when agriculture and production in the U.S., it seemed everything was in surplus.
It was.
And I began to wonder, what am I doing? I'm working hard here to... increased crop yields, and all that's doing is making more surplus production, which lowers the price for the struggling farmers
gives them a harder time.
Gives them a worse time. And I thought there must be some place in the world where what I know how to do could be better put to use.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to see, I don't know what farm publication it was in, but there was just a little, maybe 1 inch, one column item on this thing called International Voluntary Services.
Was it like an advertisement?
No, it wasn't an ad. It was just this publication just put it in, I guess.
A little description.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Or whatever. And so I wrote to them and... well, it took about a year. I was first scheduled to go to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was during one of the periods, of which there were many in Laos, of the stability or lack of it there was keeping new volunteers from getting over there. But Dr. Nofsinger, who was then in charge of IVS, he kept me on the kind of line dangling. But I'd come to the point where the university people were telling me, well, either you got to commit yourself to here or leave so we can bring in a... They had another guy who was scheduled to be my replacement. So
it's
they
kind of
put the pressure
him.
On me, and so I had to... contact IVS people and told them that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So then they said, okay, we'll send you to Vietnam. So that's how I got to Vietnam.
That was...
that was in
1960.
Finally, by the time I got there, actually this process had started sometime way back in mid-59.
Oh, okay. So you'd been... waiting and wondering for about 6 months. That's a long time to keep you waiting. And you had first sent in a letter in 59 or 58?
I really don't know now.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, you said it was about like a year before you heard from them.
No.
Oh.
Not a year before I heard from them.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misheard that.
The time from the time they had accepted me finally in the Washington office.
Uh-huh.
then you see, I was scheduled to go to Laos.
Right.
Sometime in fall
mm-hmm.
of 59.
Right.
But the instability in the country at the time didn't allow them to send more people in. And
not a good time. Yeah, I remember it wasn't.
That was that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I did get going to Vietnam, and I guess the end of February or March.
Okay.
In 60.
And you first went to Washington?
No, I was one of those who they didn't want to spend that much money on me. They didn't think I was worth it, I guess. Most people had been to Washington for an interview with Dr. Nofsinger, but he
right.
just talked to me over the telephone.
Really? Oh, wow.
So that was that.
Mm-hmm. So they just sent you straight on to Vietnam?
Yeah.
Oh. Just as an individual, not with a group?
Just as an individual.
Oh, that's very rare. I guess you're just a unique person.
Well, not necessarily. Well, I guess we're all unique, but...
Yes.
but not especially unique.
Okay. So a lot of the normal things, you know, like a meeting in New York, in Washington, and, you know, all that orientation, and then the beginnings of language training didn't apply to you. You went straight on to Saigon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so as you head off to this new place, and when you arrive, what were some of your first impressions when you got there?
I really don't know. You know, I had been in the Philippines for the better part of 2 years.
Oh, really? With the military? With the military, yeah. Okay.
And so the tropical conditions and all of that were no surprise to me.
Okay. That's rare. Most people would have come, you know, like straight from school and had never left the United States.
Yeah.
And it was a big surprise, but you already had it muted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then you just arrive, and you know the climate, you know the at least some of the foods, although Vietnamese food is very different from Filipino.
Yeah.
But at least you're comfortable with the crowdedness and the smells and the sounds and
I would say so.
Yeah, okay. Because that would affect a lot of people when they're first, you know, being buffeted by those
mm-hmm.
by those things. So who did you meet from IVS who would take you around? How did they integrate you into this new system?
Well, Brock took me around to the
okay.
different stations.
Okay.
So I was familiar with all the stations, and there were only 20 members in
mm-hmm.
IVS at the time.
Yeah, it was very tiny.
So I met 19 of them.
And you were the other one.
I was the other one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I didn't know that you called Brock Mueller just simply Brock.
Yeah.
Okay. All righty. I did go through the list of people that I was going to see, you know, on the rest of my trip. And so he knows that I was going to come here
uh-huh.
and said a hello to you and all that. So. What were your impressions of the people who were working in IVS at that time?
Well, I thought they were a good bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm.
That I was pretty convinced of that.
Yeah.
They were all pretty solid
mm-hmm.
individuals. But they were all individuals, too.
Uh-huh.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's...
Well, I meant as far as their job performance and competence and the like, and their background in terms of experience and such.
Well, they were all, at that time, they were all graduates of a college of agriculture.
Okay.
And so they had the training.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them had practical farm experience to
mm-hmm.
go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no trouble of conversing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And fitting in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were better than others, obviously.
That's part of human nature.
That's right.
Yeah.
And personality-wise, I guess I liked maybe about 80% of them very well, and
mm-hmm.
some of the others not quite so well.
Yeah. Well, again, that's sort of like life,
sure.
You know. And if you can get to know and like 80% of the people that you meet, that's doing pretty darn well. So, now, your first job when you wrote out your survey form and sent it back to us, the first job that you had, and I don't know if I'm going to mispronounce it, but Nahal?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. That sounds like it was going like okay for a little while and then fell apart.
Yes, kind of. See, this was one of the new experiment stations or stations that AID had put money into.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to help develop it. And we lived on the station with us IBS.
The tape. So I think we didn't get the people who were with you in that first site. Dick Peters.
Paul Sutton. And Jim Green.
Okay, so the four of you here.
Along with Chi.
Along with Mr. Chi, okay. He was the fellow assigned to help you guys out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was he actually your language instructor?
He was our language teacher, interpreter, and general all around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you describe yourself as tone deaf, huh?
Yeah, I didn't. I was probably one of the worst when it came to learning Vietnamese language.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the volunteers.
Oh.
I didn't do very well in that respect at all. And I later found out I went to take after I got out of IVS. I went to take a test for a job with the State Department.
Uh huh.
And I had passed everything else except language capability, and that kept me out.
What did they mean by language capability?
Well, it's tone deafness. They gave a test. They had a recording, and
mm-hmm.
I had to mimic it or something like that.
Oh, okay. So they could tell that you weren't hearing what was really being said.
Yeah.
Okay. That kept you out?
That's what they said. For this particular job.
Yeah. Oh.
This was a job in Korea where
mm-hmm.
where I would have had to learn the language and be out with the people, living
mm-hmm.
with them. And
mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, that's too bad.
Well, that's the way it is.
Yeah, that's the way it is. I'm sure there were other things, and
yeah.
we'll get to that a little bit later. But so you were kind of a little bit behind the others in all the language thing.
Yes.
That affected you a great deal in terms of your job, or not so much in terms of job, but maybe in social life.
Yeah, probably more in social life than in job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then how would you interact with Vietnamese people?
Well, of the younger people, they were very eager to learn English, and some of them had.
Uh-huh.
And some of them had some background in English.
Uh-huh.
And I could help them a little bit in their English.
Mm-hmm.
They would try to help me in Vietnamese, but, maybe it's one thing in which I was able to contribute little bit more than I was
then
able
you got
to
back.
Take advantage of.
Uh-huh, okay. So you would get to know the students because they would be using the language, your own language, so there wouldn't be that complication. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about other folks who were not that good at English? Were you still able to communicate a little bit?
Just a little. Uh-huh. I was able to buy a train ticket and all of these things and that. Mm-hmm. And, buy a ticket from bus ticket, train ticket from here to there, or go into a restaurant and get the
order
meal
food.
I wanted.
Yeah.
At least to that.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't get stuck with eating roast mouse or something like that. Okay. Well, the job that you had sounds kind of interesting, but it was a research job. If I get the
mostly
drift right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At this station.
Mm-hmm.
At Wisconsin, I was spent most of my time with forage crops. That's why they sent me there, because this was to be a station to develop forage crops for feeding cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what was my first assignment there at this Naho station was.
And this was just simply to test out different varieties of different crops under various conditions and soil types.
That's right.
Okay.
And then what happened when we started to say it fell apart, the Viet Cong were moving in to that area.
Where was the area exactly?
You know Phan Rang?
Okay.
Bay of, the famous bay there?
Yeah.
It was just to the south, maybe 15 miles. 20 miles.
All right, just so that I get it in my little mental map, which may not be perfect, but at least it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, then the local Vietnamese military people, who was responsible for us, for our security, he says it was too dangerous for us to stay there.
Okay.
So that's Jim Green and I were the IVS's. Dick Peters and Paul Sutton had already left.
Oh, their term of service had concluded? Or?
No, Paul's had. Paul went home, and Dick became Brockmuller's assistant in Saigon. So they were gone, but... Jim Green and I got this order from the Vietnamese military fellow that we had to move out and move into town where they could protect us a little better.
Do you think in retrospect they were right?
I don't
know. Or maybe just...
I don't know.
Okay.
So... we were then about 20 miles away from our work, and the communication, the travel back and forth started to become somewhat of a problem. Well, and we started to then explore other things where we might be of, well, I don't know what else did happen to Naho. My memory on that is kind of fuzzy.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the Viet Cong had moved in pretty heavy, because we didn't go there any more than maybe one or two days a week.
Oh, really?
For whatever reason. This is a gap in my memory that you have uncovered.
Uh-oh. Exposed it.
Yeah,
well, no, you did say that things seemed to wind down there, and I assumed it was because of insurgency.
That was one part of it. Then I guess the other thing we begin to feel as far as the IVS overall mission, that we were supposed to be involved more with the people and their problems. And we were kind of stuck on this USA-funded experiment station, which was rather limiting in that respect, except for the people on the station themselves.
You mean the Naho station was limiting?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It kind of restricted us to the station itself. And we, I guess, on our own, or where the inspiration came from right now, I don't know. We were looking for more opportunities to be out with working farmers and other people in need of something that we could do worthwhile. So we started making other contacts, and this led us to, among other things, a little farther up the coast towards Nha Trang. We first met this fellow at this Pasteur Institute, where he was, this was a place to develop vaccines for several different diseases.
Common sorts of things like smallpox and the like?
I guess so.
Okay.
But whatever they were, these were the kind of vaccines that you needed animals to go through a certain part of the stage.
Right.
And they had hundreds of cattle and horses there, and I guess maybe some tropical sheep that they had to feed to as part of this process. And the Vietnamese man in charge, a Dr. Fay, he was a very good veterinarian and very good on the animal side, but he said he needed help in growing forages, which was...
Okay, well, that's where you come in.
That's where we came in. So we worked maybe a couple days a week on that. That was mostly, I guess, Jim Green and myself.
Okay.
So that was where... maybe a better part of a year with that involvement.
So that was with Dr. Fay and his programs at the Pasteur Institute.
Yeah.
What other things in this new assignment did you do?
Well, then, since we were in that area, then you hear about different things. And this, and we heard about these mountaineer refugees who had been forced out of their mountain homes by the Viet Cong, and they were in a settlement not too far away from this, maybe within 5 or 6 miles, and they needed lots of help. So we, first year, we were able to get them some rice seed. I guess it was, the funds probably came from CIA. They had a front organization. Wasn't there something, was Near East Foundation or East something Foundation?
I don't know.
That the money was channeled through?
I'm sure they had some sort of organization that kind of stuff.
It didn't come from aid, I know that.
Oh, really?
It was from the U.S. government. And they provided us some rice seed at the right time. And we hauled it from some place to another. At least I did. That is when I came down with hepatitis. The other fellows, Jim Green, and maybe there was somebody else who joined us at that time. Yeah, Everett, I guess. They had gone to Saigon for some meeting. But then this... working with this rice seed thing, that was kind of my kind of thing, you know, too.
Right.
So I was going to stay back for a couple of days and take care of this mission, hauling this rice seed to these people who needed it. And I worked very hard for 2 days, and then I came down about as sick as I ever was in my life. I was one of these who never quite developed this resistance to diarrhea. I had it off and on, and I thought, well, this is a hard kind of diarrhea I'm getting now. But I'll get over it. I'll take some of these pills that I've taken before.
Little things?
Yeah, and it didn't work. I just got sicker. After I had gone out and worked for 2 days hauling these 150-pound bags, you know, this is one of the strange things where people are very small, weigh about 75 pounds. They have these great big gunny sacks where they put in twice as much as our 250-pound American laborers would lift, but these little guys who weigh 190 pounds or something like that.
190 is already fairly big.
I mean, 90 pounds.
Okay, 90
to
pounds,
100
yeah.
pounds.
Uh-huh.
They carry these big things, and that's the things I was bucking with myself. And, well, after 2 days, I just broke down, and I just managed to drag myself to the train station and get a ticket to Saigon and drag myself off into a taxi and got to the hospital. I didn't even stop at IVS headquarters. I went directly to the hospital and they got me in, and the doctor looked at me and said, "I know what's wrong with you," so they put me to bed right away. But anyway, that was just a little bit of a side diversion.
Well, but it was an important side diversion.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Since I went and met my wife at it.
Yeah. Since your present wife, well, your I guess your only wife, yeah. was the nurse who was on the team,
yeah.
took care of you.
That's right.
Yeah.
But anyway, then fortunately I did get the rice seed to these people who needed it. And I was sick for about 3 months before they allowed me to come back to work.
3 months? Wow.
And by the time I did, I was able to come back to visit. The crop was growing very nicely, and it all seemed kind of worthwhile. And I guess that was pretty much the highlight of my work.
Well, I thought there was a couple of other interesting things too, just to brief mentions, because you only briefly mentioned them too, but making of wheelchairs.
Oh yes. I have to give the credit to more to Jim Green than myself on this.
I think you did in your written form, too.
I did
too.
Some Sunday school class teaching when I was up in Ashland. And the kids kept sending me money to do something with. And we saw these crippled kids, and we just kind of, it was obvious it'd be nice if they had some way of getting around a little, so.
Sure, sure.
Jim was much more mechanical minded than I am. So he actually did most of the engineering and most of the actual work. It was funds that I was able to divert to him that did that. And then once we did that, we made two or three of these things and got around. All kinds of crippled kids were being brought to us.
No kidding. Wow.
And then we heard about these traveling doctors in Saigon. Narcissa, do you know what those... But that doctor organization that came to Saigon from the U.S.?
Project Hope.
Project Hope.
Right, in the ship.
Yeah.
Did they have that big white ship?
I guess so.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
And so we were able to get some of these kids in there for...
You brought them in?
Yeah, for surgery. Yeah, that was...
Was there anything in particular that was wrong with them? I mean, anything...
Oh, yes, they had terrible deformities.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I wish I had those pictures of I don't know. I guess we don't have any of those pictures, do we, Narcissa? I don't know where they are anymore.
Okay.
But, yeah, there were very, very serious deformities. Most of them were unable to walk at all.
Okay, so these were not in any way war-related.
Oh, no, no.
Because they may have been later.
Yeah.
With amputees and the like. But this is just simple deformities that may have been for some other reason.
Yeah.
Obviously, some other reason, but I mean...
Yeah.
Hmm.
And let's see, what else was there? You said there were two things. I can't remember. What else?
Did I say two?
Oh. there was a little interesting thing that did happen to me. In one of my... When I recovered from this hepatitis,
mm-hmm.
the road that we would normally take to come back to Thupcham, where we were living,
mm-hmm.
Was declared unsafe because of the Viet Cong. So I was flown in one of these little planes that U.S. government had over there,
uh-huh.
to a cow pasture landing strip. And when I got off the plane, the fellow who was greeting me was a fellow by the name of Phil Schreiber, who lives in Oregon, who your partner will undoubtedly get to. And by this time, I was an expert in hepatitis.
Yes.
And I looked at Phil, and I saw he had the same condition that I had left in some months earlier.
Phil
and
Schreiber.
I said, Phil, you had better get on this plane back. And he did.
Oh.
So I guess he was the second one from Thupcham who came down with hepatitis.
Phil Schreiber.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Minneville, Oregon.
And one of the other interesting things that happened in traveling on the train, I was coming back to from Saigon to Thupcham.
Uh-huh.
Thupcham was right on the railroad station, right on the railroad, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't much of a town, but it was on the railroad, and they had a station, and they stopped there.
Okay.
So that was a good thing. But anyway, along the way, there was also Vietnamese soldiers on the same car.
Along with you?
Along with me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were standing by the window with their big hats on so everybody knew who they were. And one of those everybody's along the way, I guess, was a Viet Cong in the bush with a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And he shot. He shot two or three times. And the train was, it was a comfortable and pleasant train, all of that, but the walls were not too thick. And so the bullets went right through,
sure.
And they came right over my head. I missed my head about a few inches. Could see where they went out of the car, which was just
too
near
close.
My head.
Yeah.
And so I could have been the first IVSer in Vietnam to have died from bullet wounds. It came with inches,
mm-hmm.
from it at least. And like I said, ironically, Peter Hunting, who was my replacement, was the first one for that unfortunate,
mm-hmm.
thing.
How would you describe Peter?
Well, as I say, I only spent one day with him.
Uh-huh.
And He was, my impression was that he was highly intelligent, very capable, and hard-driving type of person who knew what he wanted to accomplish. And set out about to do it.
Yeah, I think you said before, this is before we started the tape, that he was looking at IVS to obviously do some good work, but also for his own future. That he was interested in foreign services. Well, sometimes the good, the intelligent, and dedicated don't.
Don't have a chance.
That's
right.
Well, certainly, bullets don't respect that.
They'll
just go through anything. When you say that he was, he replaced you, that was in which assignment?
No assignment in particular. Just on the list.
Oh, okay, all right. So he didn't come into your area, because
He came to the same living place that I vacated.
Okay.
I think he was probably one of these people who came by himself, too. This was when we were still, I believe they were still limited to 20. And then they started, maybe they had increased somewhat, because I think he was probably the first, or he must have been the first, who was not a bona fide agriculturalist. I think that is correct. You could check that out with somebody else.
Well, I don't know who, but I just wanted to
see. They brought in this community. He might have come with the first community development group. And that would have been shortly after I left.
They have him down here as 1965.
65?
I don't know if that makes sense. Because you were gone by 62, and you couldn't have known him then. There must be some mistake here.
See, when I knew him, this was one of the times I had come back there to visit IVS.
Oh, okay. Well, then that would have... That would stand to reason, then.
But I can't remember that being 65. I would have thought it was 63 or 64 at the latest.
Well, I'll probably just check some of the newspaper clippings.
To
check for the date of when he died, and then obviously you had to have met before sometime.
Might have been 65 when he died.
Could have been.
But anyway, that I won't argue too much on that, because there is this bit of haziness.
Well, I won't argue either, because it's their records, not mine. So, I know that there are some mistakes in the records here.
But since it is that I met him on a visit rather than on, he didn't come right in and the day before I left, and I said, "Here it is, Peter." Nothing like that.
You seem to say that in your survey that you had better luck in the work that was done at the Natrang site as opposed to the Na Ho, mostly because of the extension worker there.
It was a different situation. Now, we were getting out there. I felt we were getting out doing the kind of thing that IVS was intended to do, which they recruited us to do. And we were really not under the wing of some AID person telling us what we ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
AID, there was, except we were getting our pay from AID, I mean mm-hmm. our allowance. Our allowance was coming from AID.
Uh-huh.
But that's all.
No orders.
No orders.
Uh-huh.
Which we had been getting.
When you were still at Nahal.
At the station.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you mentioned something about how the results of your work with forage crops at Natrang were very good because you could take data from Nahal.
Yeah, that's right.
Wouldn't that data lose validity because of site differences?
It was not so much the data as taking the planting materials themselves.
Oh, I got it. Okay, I thought it was the data collection. I was wondering how that. I thought that would have been.
That was the
too
good
strange.
Thing. That was a good thing that we were able to get out of all of our earlier work. Uh-huh. See, most of these forage, these tropical forage plants, you can propagate them vegetatively,
mm-hmm.
and some of them by seed, of course, too. Other things by seed.
Yeah.
And we had that reserve still at Nahal, and we were able to take that then to this project and at the Pasteur Institute.
I think get it going right away.
Yeah.
Okay. I was a little bit unclear about what you were.
Well,
what you were meaning there.
Yeah, it's a good thing you cleared that up.
Well. Looks like you're ready to.
No,
I don't care. Oh, okay. Okay, because
oh,
you.
Yeah, well, here's some of these pictures.
Some of these pictures?
Narcissus and found.
Look at that. I think that is the wheelchair that you.
Yeah, that's one of
the. Oh, there's one of the wheelchairs, yeah. Let me turn off the tape here while we're. There we go. Because we've taken a look at those photographs. I remember when I was reading over your form, you were saying that. In the experimental area for the forage crops, some of the fences were cut.
Oh, yes. This was at with the Pasteur Institute people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there were farmers or herdsmen around there with
mm-hmm.
with the free-range grazing.
Yeah.
That was the type of thing they did there.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with that. That was in the hills of Zambales, where they'd have, you know, not the immediate shoreline and then mountain, but a pretty wide area for foothills
mm-hmm.
and free-ranging cattle
yeah,
going all
yeah.
over the place.
And this was I guess, period where some of them, there just wasn't enough feed for somebody to